Welcome, everyone. I'm opening the Joint Interim Committee on Legislative Audits, Information Management, and Technology for Wednesday, January 15th. This is my first time getting to chair this committee, so it's very exciting. So thanks, everyone, for being here. We're going to start today with the introduction of the State of Oregon's new CIO, Alex Pettit, and then we'll have some time to get to know him and ask him a couple questions. And then we'll move on to a discussion on Cover Oregon, specifically focusing on the technical process of where we are with the website. And we'll have time for questions from the committee at that point. So let's go ahead and get started. Can we have the first panel? Come on up. I'm going to open an informational hearing for the introduction of the new state CIO.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record is Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer and the director at the Department of Administrative Services. It's my pleasure, extreme pleasure, to introduce for you today the new state chief information officer, Alex Pettit. Just for a little context on how we came to be with Mr. Pettit, we ran a nationwide recruitment process. We had the help of an outside executive recruiting firm. We had over 100 applicants for the position. We ran the finalists for that through a gauntlet of panels made up both of employees from the Chief Information Officer's office, from CIOs from state agencies on another panel, and agency heads and some outside technology experts from outside of state government on another panel. And Mr. Pettit survived and still agreed to come work with us after we'd put him through that. He started with us just a week ago, last week. His most recent experience is the state of Oklahoma, where he was their first chief information technology and telecommunications secretary. That was a secretary position in the governor's office in Oklahoma. But he also brings significant private sector experience with Marsh Risk Consulting, Ernst & Young, and AT&T Wireless over the course of his career. He is a candidate for a doctoral degree, comes really, really well qualified and with a great experience. Particularly, his experience at the state of Oklahoma was that there was a legislative mandate for consolidation of technology services in the state. Between the time he started and the time he left, that consolidation brought about 1,000 technology employees from 132 different agencies under his authority as the chief technology officer for the state. So he brings some experience in consolidation and all of the different discussions that need to occur to still be responsive, and we're really looking forward to working with him. I wanted also to mention that Mr. Pettit is the first chief information officer for Oregon to be hired under a new statute that was passed in the last session, House Bill 3258, which makes his employment subject to the governor's pleasure. And the governor was involved in this discussion to hire him also. He has taken on under that statute all of the duties regarding technology and telecommunications that were the purview of the director at the Department of Administrative Services previously. So I am just absolutely ecstatic that he is here. Also, probably the most important, at least in my view, job that faces Mr. Pettit in the immediate future is to develop a consolidated strategic plan for technology and telecommunications for the state, bring that to this body to be able to get a much better fix on where we are headed. Since 3258 passed, We have been working over the course of the interim. Representative Vega Peterson has been involved, and so has was Representative Harker, in us developing a new governance model for the state of Oregon regarding technology decisions. That model is now, the architecture is complete. We will be reporting to the February session our progress on that, and we are right at the point of implementing that new model. It will require the establishment of some strategic technology offices in the different policy areas of state government, which will really be the kind of traffic cops and consultants, if you will, internally for agencies regarding technology issues. I've probably said too much, so I will stop there and I allow Mr. Pettit any opening remarks, and I know that the committee may have some questions.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Alex Pettit. I'm the newly appointed Chief Information Officer for the state of Oregon, and I'm just really delighted to be here. So I don't really have a whole lot to start off with. I guess I'll just open it up to questions if there are any that I can answer.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Pettit. And I just wanted to make note that we're both graduates of Loyola University Chicago, so it's nice to have
ma'am.
A fellow Rambler in the building.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Pettit. I'm just wondering if you played a role at all in Oklahoma's health insurance exchange.
Yes, ma'am, we did. We had looked at, of course, the state of Oklahoma had been offered $52 million to establish a health care exchange. We had a cabinet meeting regarding it, and the discussion as it went, as we changed administrations from Governor Henry to Governor Fallon, and so I was reappointed by Governor Fallon. The discussion went that really ultimately we determined that we did not have the capacity to stand up, that the state of Oklahoma did not have the capacity to stand up a health insurance exchange. And so we returned the money to the federal government and we went with the federal exchange.
Mr. Pettit, welcome to our state. I think you'll find it to be a wonderful place to live. We have many things to do here. It's not going to be like Oklahoma, but I'd like to welcome you here and wish you good well in your job. And hope that you can assist us in getting us to the next generation of technology that we need for our state.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pettit, my memory doesn't serve me very well. We have a huge investment or partnership with our what we call our portal program and our contractor, which the name escapes me. Was Oklahoma one of the states that's involved with that contractor?
With NIC, the contractor's NIC, and yes, Oklahoma also had a portal contract with them. Our construction of it was different than how yours is in some regards with where we chose to host our information. We host it instead of they hosting the portal and what have you. They have a facility in Dallas that they host for Oregon. In Oklahoma, that was hosted by my shop in my office, and all of the intellectual property and all of that belonged to the state of Oklahoma. So it was a little different model than what you're using here.
My question was, you're familiar with them, so
yes, sir.
We've got a significant partnership that we envisioned with them, and I'm glad to know that you're very familiar with it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They were one of the first folks that called me, and we're glad to know that I came here, and we're looking forward to working with me still. So, yes, sir.
Good.
Senator Devlin.
Mr. Pettit, welcome, and my sympathies to you for also your wishes. Could you talk to us a little bit more about your background and particularly some of the challenges you've had in other work environments? Some of the things that will probably come up in the discussion after this discussion are old issues that seem to always be around in terms of IT projects. Did we have the right people on site with the right, knowledge, skills, and abilities to put the system in place? Was the scope of what we were trying to do beyond our capabilities? And sometimes it's in the opposite direction also. We've done too little sometimes, so that we really had to come back and revise what we've done almost immediately. Just some of your experiences with that. In terms of, too, I mean, one of the common things that we see, and, you know, this is a pretty diversified state government. We probably have more agencies than most states because we tend to divide up things into little, with the exception of human services. But just because, and I'm a layperson, but just because someone has been the IT director for an agency, and I'm talking about, we have dozens and dozens of agencies, they may be a very capable person. They may know how to manage their existing systems. But sometimes they don't appear to be the person that should be actually implementing a new system or have the capabilities there. I'd just like to hear more about your background, actually.
Sure. No problem. I think the most important thing when developing any system is a clear articulation of what it is you're trying to accomplish. What is the specific outcome you're trying to achieve? And then from that, the prioritization of those, because usually that's a multifaceted thing. That's not just a single outcome. It has a lot of different things associated with it. So when you prioritize what is really the most important thing you're trying to accomplish and setting that as the first system boundary, I'm a believer in incremental delivery. I don't like big bangs. I don't like changing the whole world overnight. It's about being able to move yourself towards what is understood as the common goal or the mental model that we're all trying to accomplish. In my first week and 2 days, it seems like all the questions I ask are about what's philosophically what we're doing and what it is we're trying to accomplish. Oregon is very pragmatic and very, very focused on things that are around efficiency and effectiveness. And I'm trying to distill the philosophies behind what it is that we're trying to really accomplish. What are the values? Because unless you have those understood, you can. I defend my dissertation in about a month on February the 11th, and my thesis is that agile development can make you stupid, and so agile is a methodology that we use in IT, and it has to do with incremental delivery and rapidly developing and prototyping things, and you lose, and my thesis is, and my research has shown that we lose track of what it is we're really trying to accomplish. We don't identify or articulate that goal or those values, and we get so caught up in the technology and focused in the, so specific to Oklahoma, I was privileged to be there, to be on Governor Henry's cabinet and then later on Governor Fallon's cabinet. And all but myself and Gary Ridley were exchanged as cabinet members from going from a moderate Democrat to a conservative Republican. And many of the agency heads turned over, and many of the boards and commissions turned over in Oklahoma during that time, from 2010 to 2011. Not a single in-flight program or project, IT project, changed their deliverables. So that was a very clear sign to me that there was a disconnect between what we were doing and overall what the organization's trying to achieve. That gap, that hole in the linkage, I really articulated as being, I feel, is that we've become so focused on delivering those things out of context that we've lost track of what is it that we're really trying to do here. So not to philosophize too great for you or to go into too much of my research, but that's really my passion, is to understand how to link what we're doing with what it is that we really value, and trying to distill that from the leadership of the organization to be able to quantify that and say, this is really what we're trying to do here. So, and articulate around that.
Follow up. Actually, both for you and Mr. Jordan, I know the bill that was passed was fairly extensive. I'm trying to recall everything that was in the bill. That's not always possible when you have 3,500 bills in an average long session here. But we sometimes create people in positions, but we don't give them the normal authority you would expect that they would have. Do you believe in your position, and I'd like Mr. Jordan to respond too, and obviously Mr. Jordan as the Chief Operating Officer and as the Director of DAS would have ultimate say, but in your position, I'm not going to really pick on them, but because I think they're doing a pretty fair job right now, but let's say the Department of Revenue wanted to modify something in an IT project. Would you have the ability in your position to say no?
Perhaps I should start.
Yes.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, the short answer is yes.
Okay.
The short answer is yes. The more complex answer is that we have a fairly lengthy historical culture of not saying no. And I believe I mentioned this governance model that we're putting in place and implementing and giving some human resource to be able to implement well. The agencies currently are contributing that human resource. They have been at the table and have developed this governance model themselves. One of the goals of that model is to get our arms around and constrain, for one thing, the proliferation of applications in our system. We are now at over 2,800 applications in the executive branch of state government, and that's about 1,000 applications more than our peer states. And it's roughly double what would be considered world class for our kind of an organization. So the governance model needs to get its arms around, and I believe we have the authority to be able to say no to an agency, or you're going to collaborate with another agency because this is a like need, and be able to do that. So I believe we do.
Well, again, welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you, sir.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sir, I too would like to add my welcome to you, and have great hopes that you can help us with our IT problems as they were. You know, there's unfortunately, we haven't had a great success with large IT ventures in Oregon in my 20-some years now being around this process.
We've had some good ones. They just don't get very much news.
We have, but sort of the unfortunate sort of joke that goes around is when an agency administrator convinces the legislature that they ought to fund a project, the response is, congratulations on your success. Have you started polishing your resume?
Indeed.
So I don't wish that upon you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Pettit, one question to follow up with what Senator Devlin was talking about. Do you have, or maybe Mr. Jordan, you can answer this, do you have the authority to move your team and integrate your team with different personnel so that if you don't think someone's quite up to snuff to handle this, do you have the authority to slide them out, put someone else in that has that ability, or is this something that has to go up the ladder?
I'll start again, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Olson. Currently, the Chief Information Officer has a staff that in his office that he has complete authority over. There's no question. We are setting up these technology offices to be integrated with the agencies, and they will report directly to him. We're attempting to begin that model of having embedded staff with particular expertise to help agencies navigate technology, but having the authority for that navigation come back to the chief technology or chief information officer. So we're beginning to embark on the ability for him to be able to replace and move personnel as he sees fit. I will tell you, however, chief information officers in agencies report to the agency head, not to our office. So.
Are you going to change that?
I think we're going to have a discussion with agencies about how authority should work and how we get the best product. One of our challenges, certainly with the organizational structure we have and the culture that we've developed, is fragmentation. And one aspect or one indicator of that is what I was talking about regarding the proliferation of applications in our system. We do have examples the other way. The state data center is an example of consolidation of infrastructure and looking at ways to do things collectively as an enterprise. My preference is that we find our balance. Large organizations like ours, and even in the private sector, if you look at them, for central services generally, not just technology, tend to swing on about a 15-year cycle from complete centralization to complete decentralization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get to complete centralization, and within about a decade to a decade and a half, people are so upset with the central authority that they decide, you know, we really need to decentralize and be more nimble and responsive to our business lines and blah, 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 blah. And you go to complete decentralization. About 15 years later, everybody understands that we're way too fragmented. We can't control anything, and we've got to centralize it all. We need to find our balance on that question. One of the big components of this IT governance model I'm talking about is that it is a structure of decision making with appropriate authorities in appropriate places, we're hoping, to be able to both be responsive to individual programmatic need of a business line that needs a technology tool to help it versus when should that tool be a shared service among like agencies. Let's take licensing, for instance. Or when should that technology be elevated to the enterprise level because it is something we should all benefit from? And so putting a governance model in place that can actually make those decisions is our goal right now, and that governance model will be accountable to the Chief Information Officer. So we're on a path to look at that kind of authority model.
Follow up?
Yes.
Mr. Pettit, are your bags still packed?
I got here a week ago. I guess it's going to be 2 weeks ago this Saturday. So the direct answer to the question is yes. I haven't had time to unpack, you know, most of the boxes. I'm still sorting my way through them. But no, I don't have any. My plans are, my projection is to unpack. So.
Good. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here and welcome, and we look forward to working with you and hearing more from the progress that you guys are making.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'll close the informational hearing and open an informational hearing for an update on Cover Oregon. We'll have Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Aaron Kajala come up.
Okay. Good morning, co-chairs Vega Peterson and Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg. I'm the interim director of Cover Oregon. With me this morning is Aaron Kajala, who's the chief information officer for Cover Oregon. Since you last met, Rocky King, who was the executive director of Cover Oregon, resigned. I've taken leave from my previous position as OHA director and am now the interim executive director of Cover Oregon as the Cover Oregon board embarks on a search with which they've begun for a permanent executive director of Cover Oregon. And, you know, in my new capacity, I'm here to give you an update on where we are, particularly today, clearly focusing on the issues of technology. So let me start on the technology side. I'm going to give you a high-level update, and then going to turn it over to Aaron Kajala to get a little bit more down to the ground on some of the functioning of the technology. You know, it's no secret to anybody in this room or in the state that we do not have a fully functioning website today, the kind of website that we had wanted to be able to process in enrollment and get people to enroll end-to-end by going online. Right now, we're using what is, in essence, we're in a contingency mode and using a hybrid system. Parts of the system are working, which we're using, and parts are not, and we'll walk you through that. We really understand that the system is not where we want it to be. We appreciate that each and every Cover Oregon customer who has applied and gone through the process, that it's been much more difficult than we would have liked it to be. We are enrolling people. More than 65,000 people have enrolled so far through Cover Oregon, about 23,000 in private plans, And as you may have seen, starting to be in alignment with other states in terms of the numbers of enrollments. We've been able to do that by retooling the process. We're clearly in a contingency mode at this point. We are parts of the process to enroll are manual. Individuals can put in an application online, but then we need to manually enter it into the eligibility system. The eligibility system works to determine eligibility. We then can get people their information, and then they need to enroll. They can then come back and enroll online to us, and we get those enrollments to the carriers. And we'll go through that in a little bit more detail in a moment. You know, I think the biggest question that people have right now is, so when will this website be operational? You know, as I've indicated, parts currently are indeed working. Over the next few weeks, Oracle is entering into an intense period of testing in a variety of key areas of the website that have been worked on over the last 2 months. And I believe that at the end of that period of time, we're going to have a better sense of when we will have a fully functioning website for the state. And Aaron is going to walk you through that. Early in December, when I started, there were about 48 critical problems with the website that have been identified over the last 2 months. Been working through those down to about 13, and Aaron will go through that. And over the next couple of weeks, as more of those are put through into a testing environment, we'll have a much better idea as to where we are. But before Aaron starts, I really want to talk about two particular activities. One is how we're working with Oracle, our current vendor, and, you know, two, about, you know, future contingency plans for us. So I think, as you know, our main technology vendor and partner, people who are helping us build this website, is Oracle. We are indeed relying on them to build a functioning system. We've made a large investment in this. We're working collaboratively right now to get the website up and operational and fully launched. At the same time, everyone, including Oracle, is aware that we don't have the kind of functionality and ability for someone to enroll that indeed we contracted with them for. You know, until we have that, further payment is contingent on having that kind of a functioning website. You know, so far that's a bit more than $20 million that are withheld and continue to be contingent upon having a functioning website. You know, in addition, have done a number of things since I've started. Number one, I've Mr. Greg Van Pelt working with me to help provide advice and input into running the organization. We've hired an outside attorney to look at the additional options that we have under the current contract to hold our contractor accountable. One of the issues that we've experienced over the last several months has been to really look at the quality and function of the code that's been written for the system. You've heard about that. Brought in two experts in this particular kind of code and system function to look at the accuracy of an integrity of that coding, and have recently brought in some additional outside expertise to make sure that we have the appropriate systems in place to bring the system to functionality during open enrollment. In terms of contingency planning, we are in contingency planning now. We don't have the website that we had wanted. We're in a contingency mode. That means relying on part manual and part electronic function to enroll people. It's not where we would like things to be. I think that because of that, beginning to look at some contingency planning for the future. If indeed we are unable to have a website that is operational for open enrollment, we need to begin to start to look at beyond March, what are our contingencies? Can we leverage parts of the current system? Can we look at other functioning technologies, whether that be other state systems or parts of the federal system to help with electronic enrollment? So begun to look at that process. Again, I don't think that we are at the point in time to make that decision, but indeed we need to begin that planning. So we have begun that. The last thing I guess I'd like to cover before turning it over to Aaron is really to talk just for a moment about really what this is about, which is really about the consumer and the customer experience. In the end, we talk a lot about the technology, but really what we're talking about is getting people health care. It's vitally important. It's about the consumer experience. And indeed, what we have to date has not been the kind of consumer and the kind of customer experience that we'd like. When we began to enroll people a couple of months ago, we were putting together a new process. It was not where we had intended to be. We needed to very rapidly, as I think you know, we've hired several hundred people to help process these applications. Those individuals all had to be trained in what is a brand new process that had not existed before. This was clearly a contingency. And from the start, it has not been as smooth as we would like. As we've continued to gain experience with the process, it has gotten smoother as we have been able to reduce cycle times, brought in some lean experts to help us look at cycle times. Some of the technology has been improved along the way to help do that. We've added additional resources in the call center. And, indeed, we've also had issues of 170,000 people now in the state coming into care at the same time. Call volumes in our call centers have been high, and people have had a lot of questions about their new coverage. We know it's been difficult for customers. It's been difficult for agents. It's been difficult for carriers. I think that we need to give a lot of credit to our insurance carriers and agents around the state for helping work with us during what's been a difficult process. And as we work to improve the enrollment process, we're also working to improve how we communicate with people about where they are in the process. We know it can be really frightening for people as they don't know where they are. There have been a lot of people that have been able to enroll smoothly through this process. And there are also a lot of people that have had difficulties. And our goal ultimately is to continue to work, and that commitment is to continue to work to make certain that everybody has a smooth experience in being able to get coverage. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn things over to Aaron, who can take things down to a more technical level.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, I don't want to diminish the frustrations with and the discussions we've had about the website and the problems there, but for me at least, this has never been about a whiz-bang website. This has been about getting people covered with insurance. And I think what's been lost in the media, focusing on what isn't working, is the fact that we have almost 200,000 Oregonians now covered with insurance that weren't covered before. We certainly want to do better, and I'm more concerned about how we get the people who need insurance covered so that we can get some control on costs and other things. than that. So, I want to applaud your efforts and the team's efforts for getting those people in covered. And I guess one of the things I would hope that we would talk about as we go into session in February is, are there things that we can do to help with that while we're fixing the technological things? I have all the confidence that sometime in the next year you're going to fix the technical things, but that's not really the issue. The real issue is, how do we get people covered?
Co-chairs, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, and my job right now is really twofold. It is getting people enrolled, and it is also getting this website up and operational, because indeed that's a vehicle to getting people the coverage that they need, and to be certain that we get the value for the investment that we've made in this, and that's my role.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. A question I have is my assumption correct that and the number I've heard is 596,000 uninsured Oregonians before this process started?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, members of the committee, approximately 600,000 Oregonians uninsured.
Thank you. Then the question I ask is, when this process is all over, running smoothly, how many of those people will be uninsured, and how many will still remain uninsured?
Co-chair, Senator Olson, members of the committee, the estimates that we had been working off of is that by the end of approximately 2016, over the next 2 years, that somewhere close to around 500,000 individuals will be covered through a combination of the Medicaid expansion, as well as through the Cover Oregon and the commercial and insurance environment. So left with somewhere around 100,000 uninsured. But again, an estimate, and we'll see if that's where we end up at the end.
Follow up?
Yes.
Do you have, perchance, a cost estimate at the end of 2016, what the dollar figure will be? Do you have any projections?
Off the top of my head, I don't have a number figure now. What we can get you is there have been some good cost estimates for the Medicaid expansion and exactly what that will cost. We can get you that, as well as the cost projections for the Cover Oregon enrollments, and can get you that through 2016.
Hello? With you bringing on these new folks to advise senior leadership, Mr. Pettit, Mr. Van Pelt, is he paid or unpaid?
Mr. Van Pelt is not paid.
Not paid. And the other folks that you brought on to assist, are they paid or unpaid?
Those individuals will be paid. We're working out contracts.
How do we follow up? Thank you. How do we cover this? Where does the money come from?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, members of the committee, we have a budget for 2014, and we are adjusting that budget, cutting expenses in other places to be able to make these expenditures.
So you're cutting your budget, but are other people losing because you're cutting a budget from someplace to pay for these other people we need to bring on to get this thing working?
We're cutting such things such as reducing the expenses that we're paying for advertising and marketing, and reducing some of the future contracts that we may have. And so working to clearly live within the budget that we have from the feds, but we're at the beginning of a one-year budget cycle and believe that we can make some of those adjustments to accommodate this and still remain within our budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Let's, Aaron, if you wouldn't mind going ahead, so to make sure we have time for your presentation.
Sure.
We'll have more questions after.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Cardula. I'm the Chief Information Officer for Cover Oregon. Today I'm going to provide a systems update. I want to concentrate on what is new from our last report, as well as talk about what is what is currently operational in the system, what is not currently operational in the system, and what we're doing to manage improvement in the performance and getting the system up and running. Since the last time that we briefed this committee, we have made some progress in the system. Specifically, we are now able to select and enroll in plans after receiving eligibility information. This is supporting the process that Bruce had described in terms of getting to enrollments. It's allowed us to get to the number of enrollments that we have. We've also provided the opportunity for consumers or applicants to come in and enter an online application and then also submit the eligibility determination with that. Our agents and community partners can actually go in, enter an application, go to the point of eligibility, and ultimately after receiving the eligibility determination, we can then enter in an enrollment for coverage, and then we generate notices after that so that the people know what plans are enrolled in. We've also implemented several interfaces that are automatically supporting the exchange. On the federal interfaces, we're able to do all of the legal verifications that are required for determining eligibility, which include validating a social security number, legal presence, income, whether or not somebody has minimal essential coverage. We've put in back-end systems that allow us to not only determine but store the eligibility, generate the notices, and ultimately support the hybrid process for determining eligibility and enrolling in coverage. All of this work that we've done actually will also go towards the final end-to-end website solution that we're working to implement. So this is not something that we're doing special. It is work that we're doing so that that ultimately we'll be able to bring the site fully online. So when October came and we started to look at where we were with the system and what was going to be required to complete the system, we took a lot of effort and time to not stop what we were doing, but to look at what it is that we could do to improve the situation that we were in and ultimately get to a completed system. As a result of that, we now have the highest level of Oracle leadership on site to manage progress of their teams and to keep us apprised of where they are with that progress. Oracle has also brought in their highest level system experts to ensure that the system is functioning as it should according to their expertise. They have come in, they're reviewing the performance of the system, they're looking at how the actual code in the system is functioning, and they're making recommendations and also at times making changes in the system so that we can get to a full end-to-end experience for individuals. We've also shifted to prioritizing solely on the things that it's going to take for us to get the system up and running. So the things that are blocking our ability to basically realize a successful go live, that's where we're completely focusing. We will continue after implementation, the full implementation, to then clear the other areas of the system that might have been they may be of high priority, but not absolutely necessary for getting to an end-to-end website where somebody can come in, determine their eligibility, and enroll in health coverage. As Bruce also mentioned, we have brought in several different experts to assist us in different areas. We have experts who are in for helping us with code reviews, looking at our processes and the functions of the system. We have experts coming in and helping us to look at alternatives to the system, looking at how it's functioning and making recommendations on how we move forward, not only in the short run, but in the long run, to make sure that this is that the technology viably supports our ability to enroll people in health coverage. The last thing that we've done is we've put processes in place, or we've actually improved our processes to be very conservative about what we're releasing out into the system, because we now we have a functioning hybrid system and processes, and we do not want to negatively impact that the fact that we are enrolling new people every day. So we are looking at ourselves as being in a situation where we're releasing to the public in terms of we cannot have any disruptions in service. So we've put that in place to ensure that we do not have any major system issues for when everybody's trying to use it for getting everybody enrolled. So earlier I talked about how we've shifted in managing our process. We coming into October and through October, we were looking at a large body of work that we needed to accomplish for achieving the scope of full end-to-end within the system. We looked at that and we realized that we needed to focus on the very critical things needed for bringing the system live. When it comes up, it's not going to be a perfect system, and we know that, but we need it so that it's available and accessible for individuals to come on and get their enrollment. So the graphic that you have here is not exhaustive, but what it represents is the development and test cycles that we're following. We have prioritized around those issues that are blocking our ability to go live, and we are hyper-focused on those and using the cycle to clear those issues. And we will test and we will fix that code until we're assured that it's ready to be released and ultimately can release the system. And we do that through the rigorous process that I was describing earlier. So with that, the areas of the system that are not working and the areas of the system that we're applying that process to are the ability for individuals, agents, and community partners to go on to the website and create their own accounts, the ability for those same groups to go onto the website and after they've determined eligibility either for their customer or for themselves, be able to select a plan and then enroll in a plan. On the back end system, we are still in the process of testing for our customer service agents to do the same thing. We have the ability to do that. We're using workarounds right now. The workarounds are functional, but they're not going to be as functional as when we have the full site in place. You'll see that I put in parentheses for each of these areas the number of test cycles that we've already performed on each of these areas, and these are in the recent form of those. So when you see that on the website, the ability for agents, community partners, and agents to create their own accounts through the website, we've went through three separate internal releases to our test systems. We've tested that in depth, and we're now in the process of assessing to see if those have any of those blocking issues for a go live. The reason that I put that we have either three or four test cycles in each of these areas is historically for the functionality that we've released for both in October and November and December, it's been between 3 and 5 test cycles that we've needed to achieve to get to where we needed to be to clear those blocking issues. So as you see, we're getting mature in terms of the unreleased parts of the system that we're testing right now. In addition, there are some additional items for future release which are not for consideration in this process that we're describing. Those include the ability for individuals, agents, or community partners to redetermine eligibility due to a change in life circumstance through the website. the ability to reconcile, automatically reconcile enrollments with carriers or the federal government. We have workarounds in place for that right now. And we currently have deferred SHOP functionality, the small group functionality, pending completion of the website to support individual consumers. The major milestones that we need to achieve to get to our next release are that we need to clear those remaining critical issues that I described earlier that we're hyper focused on. In December, we had 48 critical issues. As of yesterday, we had 13 critical issues, and we're clearing those every day. We have a milestone of achieving system performance to 10,000 users on the site at the same time. We are continuing the performance testing there. We're going to continue to test and tune the system. We're working very closely with Oracle, who is performing those tests. We also will have independent validation of those test results and actually independent performance of tests to verify that we're able to meet that milestone and objectives. And we're making fixes on a regular basis to improve that performance. The final milestone is, as we have in each of our releases, is to ensure that the system passes all security tests, and we are performing final security testing to validate that for this next upcoming release.
Thank you, Aaron. Questions? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions, but I'm going to have to actually give a preface to each set of questions. One of the things in terms of legislative oversight is to look at what our issues are here. And I think one of our issues is here. I was talking to a couple of reporters from the Oregonian, and they were surprised. I mean, this committee has a fancy title, Legislative Audits and Information Technology Management. It's actually, statutorily, it's two committees. There's supposed to be a Legislative Audits Committee and there's supposed to be an Information Technology Committee. But because historically the leadership has a hard time finding anyone that wants to serve on this committee, they joined the two. Also, it's
a choice.
We have an excellent committee administrator, but we've had three committee administrators in a period of less than a year. We closed down during regular sessions. So in all of 2013, during the time when this program was probably the most in need of oversight, we had two meetings. One was a beginning meeting to end new members to this, and the other was just an overview of CoverOregon. However, CoverOregon did appear numerous times before our healthcare-related committees and gave updates to them. I'm trying not to be as critical as I'm tempted to be, but I'm just trying to get down to what really happened. In the last couple of months, I've read a lot of material, read some things in news stories I wasn't aware of being a legislator, which seemed odd to me. And I talked to them that they asked me if people had lied, and I said there's a difference between a lie that's a commission to state something that's false and not stating something that should have been stated, an act of omission. And if there was a problem here, it was probably an act of omission. There is an article that I would hope that all the committee members, and I'll make it available to the committee members. It's in a magazine called Profit. It's actually a publication produced by Oracle. The November 2012 issue has a whole display on Oregon and CoverOregon and talks broadly about how Oregon saw this as an opportunity, not just for the exchange, but to update their systems around Medicaid, to potentially integrate this with systems to approve people for TANF, to approve them for SNAP, and in some cases for even some other programs. So it appears like that we had a grand design. Now, a magazine article, even though it's published in November of 2012, sometimes was written 3 or 4 months before. But the last time in 2012 that this committee met and considered this, we were told that there were problems, but we were told that they would be resolved, and that this system could come on hand or come to bear. Now, we've been used to systems. We had a lot of problems within the e-court efforts, but we got down to the core of that system and actually had so many different decision points that we could tell from almost a monthly basis where they were. And that was done with the cooperation of a separate branch of government from the executive and the legislative. And we kind of, I think, expected when we left here at the last meeting in 2012, expecting there'd be the same kind of process in Cover Oregon where item after item would be addressed. What I'm trying to figure out, and what's just driving me a little bit crazy, is, and I'm mentioning names, and I don't want to mention them in any way that it sounds disparaging, it's just factual. You know, when I met with Rocky King, he told me basically, and from what I learned from him, that they knew for sure that the system would not be operating October 1st, basically the first week in August. Then I read reports that indicate that probably some of those beliefs go back to as early as April of 2013. What I'm trying to really understand is why there wasn't an overt message that this system is not going to be operating, that we are going to have alternatives. You know, we're talking now about addressing this on a dual, getting people enrolled, which is actually the most important thing, and then improving the technology system. But it appears to me that somebody could have said, maybe as latest in August, maybe at the earliest in April, May, or June, that the system's not going to be operating. Even in all the advertising after that, which would still have been appropriate to get people enrolled, that could have been explained to the public. I'm just trying to find an answer why someone didn't come forward and say, you know, the emperor has no clothes. That's my question. Publicly saying that.
Yeah. Co-chairs Vigor Peterson, Devlin, members of the committee, I think that's a question a lot of us have. I have as well. I believe that that's a big piece of what the governor has called for, an independent review. There have been a lot of people very much involved in this, and I think that that independent review will help us answer that. I don't know the answer to that question. It's what I scratch my head about as well. And it's why, at this point, I've brought in some additional outside expertise over the next month to, if we are going to go live, I need some other technical experts to help determine whether or not that is the appropriate decision, whether or not the technology is operable, because to get to the place where we were back in September, where throughout September it looked as if we were going to launch on October 1 and then suddenly didn't, is not acceptable. And so I think you're asking a good question, and we're going to get some answers to that and in looking at it over the coming months.
I think that'll be the core question. I think it would have been much easier, Madam Chair, it would have been much easier to explain this to Oregonians if we had said in the spring or in the early summer, and that we were going to take, rather than leading people to believe this was going to be operational October 1st, and then going a couple of months, basically saying, well, it might be operational 2 weeks from now, it might not. I just think we would have been in a much better position than we are now.
I agree.
The other issue is a little bit more technical. And again, I'm mentioning the name, not to be critical, but when we met earlier in our last meeting with Rocky King, and he had a presentation, and he broke up all of the functions into a number of different areas, what was working and what was not. What I'd like to see for this committee, as soon as you could possibly get it, I don't mean tomorrow, is basically where we were October 1st and maybe somewhere in between, but going function by function to show what was not functioning then, what's functioning now. We did get a later report that was just, I think, written, but not before the committee, that showed what was in testing. But it's much easier to follow that in terms of progress when you have like a spreadsheet that says this This is not functioning now. It's in testing now, and it's functioning. Just so that we can see what progress is being made, and to the extent that we can understand what's still not functioning in the system. But something like that. Verbiage is fine, but I tend to like spreadsheets more than I like verbiage.
We can get that to you within a week.
Okay.
And you'd like it from October 1
right.
on?
Right, so I can see what progress has been made since we knew the system, or at least we had to publicly announce at that time that the system was not functioning.
Will do.
It would be helpful to have, as part of that, your projection of when that function will be operational.
I think that the point that Senator is making, and I think for the whole committee, is we need to see that progress is actually being made, because, again, the end result is making sure that we have people that are enrolled in the system, and that if there are components of the system that are going to be going by the wayside, you know, understanding that we want to get to the mission critical point of getting people enrolled, we just want to have an understanding of that is, if that's the, you know, no wrong door, or if it's the, you know, you know, tribal enrollment or these things, but we just want to make sure that we're willing to live on that. Right. Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm sure you are looking forward to this day testifying before us. In the discussions regarding contingency plans and decision points and all that, was it ever determined that there could become a point in time where we should just cut our losses and go to the federal exchange? And if not, then why not?
Co-chairs, Rep. Thatcher, members of the committee, I think at this point it is premature to make that decision. We've certainly made a large investment in this. Part of the technology is working. I believe that we will be at a point to make that decision over the next couple of months, and that's exactly why we've begun to make that planning. We've made a big investment. If that becomes operational in the next month, we'll have a system that will enroll people. However, if it does not, then I believe we will be at the point to look at leveraging parts of the existing technology so we can recoup some of the investment that's been made, to be able to use that as part of a system with perhaps another state, or perhaps with the technology of the federal exchange. So that's exactly the work we're in the process of beginning to scope out and to look at. And I think the next month will, in essence, tell us whether or not we're at a point that we need to turn to that contingency.
And that would be part of the contingency, is saying, okay.
Yes,
and
correct.
I have another question. How are hospitals and other providers being paid if that part of the system is not working? It's my understanding that they're not able to file online, and are payments current to these providers?
Co-chairs, Rep. Thatcher, members of the committee, you know, providers, hospitals, doctors bill for in insurance through, you know, regularly, and certainly for their regular, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, commercial insurance, they continue to be able to bill. For those individuals who are currently being enrolled in Cover Oregon and through plans in that marketplace, providers will be able to bill the insurer for that coverage, and the insurers have the operating systems to do that. Those systems are in place. What is not working right now, it's not the insurer's ability to pay a bill or a provider's ability to bill an insurer. The issue is getting the enrollment to the carrier.
I have another question.
Yes.
And I apologize for upfront because this is going to be a very blunt question, and it comes from a constituent. And I just want to preface it with the fact that I'm sure a number of us are getting iterations of this kind of question, and here it goes. It says, how many people at Cover Oregon have been fired or otherwise held accountable for their bungling? And if the answer is none, then why not? And why should not you, they mention you, be held accountable for failing to fire the people who created this mess and wasted so many taxpayer dollars? How would you respond?
co-chairs, Regan Peterson, Devlin, Rep Thatcher, members of the committee, I certainly am accountable for this. I have been involved from the beginning. I am accountable, and right now I'm accountable for helping to fix it. And we are working on fixing that. We are putting all of our efforts right now into fixing the system and getting people enrolled, and that's indeed where my focus is. So I'm accountable for getting this up and operational, and that's what I'm doing.
Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I appreciate your answer. I think that there have been wondering, who is, has anybody been let go because of this? Is there been some rearranging of, you know, of the structure, so to speak, to allow this to either succeed or have at least proceed in a positive fashion?
Co-chairs, Rep Thatcher, members of the committee, on a, it's one of the, I think one of the things that the independent review is going to look at is some of the ultimate responsibility and accountability for all this, and I think that you know, that that's appropriate. I think it's you know, been common knowledge to many around the state that there have been several people involved in this project that for a variety of reasons are no longer involved in the project. We have people working day to day to get this operational, and we will continue to work at that. And I think in the future, those are going to be some of the decisions that, that need to get made. Right now, the issues are function and enrollment and getting the system operational moving forward.
Madam Chair, one more question. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I know there have been a lot of, so many people, and I know some of them who are down there working 10-hour days and trying to get this going. And it's been a real difficult process for everybody. The cost for all this, you know, this extra personnel and all that, who's bearing that?
Co-chairs, Vega Peterson, Devlin, Rep Thatcher, members of the committee. The cost right now for the additional individuals, we've hired approximately 400 additional individuals to process the applications. Those costs have been split between the Oregon Health Authority as well as Cover Oregon. For the period through January 1, the cost for all of that is approximately $3.3 million. About $1.5 million of that is and I can get you the exact figures, but about, you know, a little over $1 million is Cover Oregon, and the others are the Health Authority. The Health Authority is, those costs are being paid out of the budget that was there to enroll people in Medicaid. There was a budget put forth for enrollment of individuals in Medicaid. Because of the SNAP process, the fast track SNAP process, where individuals, it's been a streamlined enrollment process in Medicaid. The Oregon Health Authority didn't need quite as many people to enroll people, the 100,000 people that came in through the SNAP process, and are using those dollars to, in essence, cover the cost of, we've enrolled 45,000, upwards of 45,000 people in Medicaid through Cover Oregon. You know, they've submitted the same application, and, you know, there have been more Medicaid enrollments through Cover Oregon than commercial enrollments at this point. That's how people have qualified. So Cover Oregon is covering those costs through that piece of it, and the health authority is covering those costs through that piece of it, and the dollars for Cover Oregon, we are, much as I indicated to Senator Olson earlier, we have a budget for the year and are covering that within our budget. We're reducing other expenses, advertising, future hiring, a variety of ways that one manages a budget, looking at renegotiating contracts, all the variety of ways one works through a budget, and I believe that we can cover those costs within the current budget.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To answer Rep. Thatcher, I think from what I understand from the news, I think we maybe lost two people, and it looks like we probably hired about 450. So it looks like we're to the plus side. But my concern is I had several notes on your PowerPoint. Now, I want to make sure I pronounce your name correctly. Is it Karjala?
Karjala.
Karjala.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. I had several questions on your PowerPoint, but the one that struck me the most was at the very back when you said on a milestone for the next release, system passes all security tests. Now, when you talk about security, are you talking hacker-proof?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson. The system security is a piece of it, and it's basically making sure there's no vulnerabilities for a hacker to come in and exploit the system in a way that we would not want them to.
Well, I'm sorry you answered the question that way, because it seems to me that the first thing we should have had done was to make certain that it wasn't hacker-proof.
Yeah, if you look closely at the milestone, it's to perform final system testing on that release, to make sure that that release has the security that's necessary. We've done that same level of testing for previous releases as well.
So we have security, because, I mean, Target had security. Neiman Marcus had security. The concern is we're asking our Oregonians, our constituents, our colleagues, and the people that live here to give out very sensitive information. And you're looking at a milestone to make certain that you can't be hacked? That makes me nervous. And that goes along with the 400 hires. Mm. We're hiring people. Are we doing background checks to make certain that these people don't pass on sensitive information? Because I opened up Cover Oregon to look, and it was a lengthy form to fill out with Social Security numbers and income, employers, everything they needed to make a new Senator Alan Olson in Oklahoma, if you will. So there could be 49 other Senator Alan Olsons in the different states. And it bothers me the fact that at the very end, your milestones for the next release are once again security. Can you assure me today that we have complete and accurate security so that our system cannot be hacked and it has been available from the very beginning?
Co-chair, Senator Olson, that's the reason we do that testing. We need to continue to do that testing as we run the system going forward.
But back to the question, can you assure me that from day one when this system went online, this system could not be hacked? And I know there's really good guys out there, but that we had a level of security that I would have on my own computer.
The system was implemented with both stringent federal policies, state policies, best practices that any other commercial website would be implemented with, as well as all of the non-system policies that would be required to run an operation that captures and stores sensitive information.
So we'd be happy to provide the committee with the security testing and all of that, and that's in addition why bringing in some additional expertise to assure that everything is in place to be certain that we do have a secure system. In terms of the personnel side of things, the individuals that have been hired to do the manual processing all go through a background check, and they get training in the handling of sensitive information. And we continue to do everything we can to assure that all information is handled in an appropriate and a secure manner.
Yeah, I'm sure one follow-up. There was a situation that was reported in the news that people received very sensitive Correct. Information. Has that been taken care of?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, yes. Initially, when we began the paper process and were handling applications, there were some instances where when things were printed off on a printer, two or three individuals' information was printed and someone pulled that off of a printer to mail to someone. And those are the types of process improvements that have been put into place. We've had experts looking through the process, and as we've identified security problems, we have indeed been fixing them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
I just did want to clarify something, and actually Senator Olson was a good lead for a portion of this. The 400 positions are limited duration.
Correct.
Part of that expenditure was actually planned for in the budget process.
Correct.
And the SNAP, I think everybody here understands this. It's simply by the people that were on SNAP, or what we commonly referred to in the past as food stamps. You had enough data on those people already to determine whether or not they were under the 138% threshold now, so you could more easily convert them over to the Oregon Health Plan. That's correct, right?
Yes, Senator Vaughn, that is correct. They've, in essence, had already been screened and qualified for a federal program, which Medicaid is. They've had, in essence, been pre-qualified, pre-screened, had their income validated, enrolled in that process, and indeed this was a way to not, in essence, duplicate similar work that had been done.
And one of our discussions, Madam Chair, one of our discussions was that the federal government probably wouldn't have been as willing to put as much money into this if it hadn't been that Oregon was one of the few, if not the only state, that was going to try to integrate the Medicaid approval at the same time. Isn't that correct?
Co-Chair Devlin, I think that the feds, it made the investment in Oregon because we had a vision of a single portal to do a variety of the Medicaid as well as other federal programs, along with the individual insurance market and the small group market. So that is, I think, why they were intrigued with what we did.
I had this discussion with the two Oregonian reporters, and I've had it with you, is sometimes language is important. And I think one of our limitations right now in how we've talked about this is we've talked about it as a website. A website, to most people, they say, well, my Uncle Joe did a website for me last week. Or every legislator probably has, or almost all of them, have websites on the outside that they paid maybe $1,000. And they think, they collect money on the website from contributions, but some of them don't realize that they contracted with an outside party to actually collect the money, because you wouldn't develop all that capability with the small appropriation. But one of the things here that's challenging, I believe, and I think is not understood about the website, is all of this approval process has to meet all the requirements for the exchange. And if you're going to try to do Medicaid at the same time, it has to meet all the requirements for Medicaid. And I would welcome the committee, or I would welcome any reporter that's looking at this, to look at Combined Federal Regulation 42, which is in five volumes, which has about 1,100 chapters, and about, I'd say somewhere between 40% and 50% of it is Medicaid. And all of the items that you'll have to build into the software to meet all of the federal requirements. That being said, I'm still terribly disappointed, you know, that that we were not more out at the forefront telling the public that this would not be ready by October 1st. But I think in some ways, hopefully the system comes up and running, because whether they're federal dollars or state dollars, they're still public dollars. And I think the benefits to having the system operational will be far outweigh walking away from it.
Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, I'm members of the committee. I agree with those observations about both the complexity of the issues at the federal level in terms of building some of this, the scope that we took on, which clearly was large, and I think are learning now as we postponed the small group market, that you know, those are decisions you need to revisit periodically, as well as I think your comment and observation about needing to know things sooner. I would definitely agree.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Goldberg.
Any other questions?
Yeah. One more question. You're talking about Medicaid. Thank you. Does a person, if a person enrolled in SNAP today, would they still automatically qualify for the Medicaid expansion coverage?
Co-Chairs Thatcher, members of the committee, not everybody in SNAP qualifies for the Medicaid expansion. Those people on SNAP whose incomes are below 138% of poverty do. But there are some SNAP recipients who I think it's up to about 180. People get SNAP benefits up to about 185% of poverty. So there are many SNAP beneficiaries who don't qualify for Medicaid expansion, only those below 138% of poverty.
All right. Thank you very much. It sounds like there's going to be in the next few weeks a lot more testing done to see what's going to be functional, what's not. So this committee is going to continue through the February session, so we're probably going to invite you back here towards the end of the month to see where you are. So good luck with it. I think all of us, we want to see people enrolled in this, and we know you have a big job ahead of you. So thank you so much for your time. I'm going to close the informational hearing on Cover Oregon. And again, just to remind the committee members that we will be meeting in February on Fridays from 3 to 4:30. So look forward to seeing you guys in February. Anything else? Thank you. We are adjourned.
Isn't that happy?